Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. Love to have Blair Horner on the show. Knows where the bodies are buried, knows what's going on. Welcome back, Blair.
You just make it sound like I'm an undertaker.
Well,
people are dying to hear us, right? Is that what you wanted to do?
Well, yeah. I remember when I was a young lad and in a car being driven out to our Fire Island home, and we were going through Queens, and there was a graveyard, and he said, people are dying to get in here.
Yeah. Well, I guess we have nowhere to go but up after this shtick, right?
That's right.
Terms of our conversation this morning.
Okay, so Shelley Silver gets convicted on all seven counts. Preet Bharara becomes victorious. Cuomo comes right out and says, justice has been served. And Speaker Hastie, otherwise known as Boss Hastie from the Bronx, all the goo-goo groups, the good government groups, all calling for reform. Hey, will we see reform?
Well, that's a very good question.
Thank you.
We will probably see something that is called reform.
Well, we've seen that again and again.
That's right. Well, that was the easy part of my prediction. Whether or not something real happens hinges, I think, on what happens in the Skelos case, and then ultimately whether or not the governor feels any heat to do anything. I mean, as you know, it's the executive that really sort of leads the charge. The legislature's, it's very hard for the legislature to organize itself, particularly when it's run by two different political parties, to organize itself around changing the rules of the political game. It really is going to take the governor to weigh in. And whether or not he chooses to do that, I think, is the open question.
He ran on a ticket to the reform, right? And so why wouldn't he? Is he a hypocrite?
You know, every governor runs as a reformer for their first term. And by the time the second term runs around, they become more and more the status quo. And so in this particular case, I think the governor is doing similar to what Governor Pataki used to do, is to try to keep his distance as much as possible from Albany so that he's not associated with the public anger toward the state capitol.
Except that the interesting thing here is that there are repeated news reports of one kind or another, and we've talked about this, that Preet Bharara, the fighting U.S. attorney, has Cuomo in his crosshairs in terms of the way things are going on in Buffalo and the way contracts are awarded and why the Moreland Act Commission was decapitated in the middle of its existence. And so Cuomo comes out and after Shelley Silver is convicted and says, you know, basically justice has been served. But on the other hand, if there's anything to the smoke, then Cuomo is in a tough spot.
But that hinges, of course, and I agree, but it hinges entirely on whether or not there's anything to the smoke. And that we don't know. We only know what's been reported. The Buffalo Billion is reportedly under scrutiny. The closing of the Moreland Commission is apparently under scrutiny. God knows what else. But being under scrutiny doesn't necessarily mean anything's going to happen. And,
right.
You know, it's entirely possible nothing will. I mean, the wild card in all this, and I think you and I have talked about this, is Bharara's term ends more or less with the same time as the president's term ends. And at some point, he has to start thinking about doing his sort of, you know, U.S. attorney triage as to whether or not he's going to want to open any more big cases with the clock running. So, I mean, I think my guess is he likes being the sheriff of State Street. My guess is he likes to, you know, attack political corruption with the same excitement that he goes after terrorists and Wall Street ripoff artists. But whether or not there's any there, we don't know. But we do know that Silver's convicted, and that's a big deal. And it's just the latest in the big game hunting that Bharara has been involved in. And what happens in the Skelos case, if he's exonerated, it takes some of the, I think, wind out of the sails for reform. But if he's convicted, then I think it's entirely possible that there'll be a lot of pressure for lawmakers to act because they face the voters in 11 months.
And they may think that if they don't do what's right, they might be next themselves.
Well, and there are some lawmakers that have outside jobs that are in districts where Democrats and Republicans have close enrollments, where it'll be used against them. And so they'll either have to get rid of their outside job or they have to be able to say, well, we dealt with that by doing X.
Yeah.
And what is the X? Who knows? And so I think there will be pressure on the legislature to act, but really it takes the governor to sort of frame the issue, advance the reform, and push the legislature to act because he's got all that leverage in the budget, and that's the place to do it.
So let's just remind everybody that we're taping this earlier in the week, and the Dean Skelos verdict may be in by the time you hear the show.
That's right.
So you'll just have to go along with that. Shelley Silver was quoted in a newspaper that I read that he really wasn't worried that much because he thought on appeal his conviction would be reversed. What are you hearing?
Well, I'm sure that that's what he hopes and thinks. There's some precedent. There's a former Senate Majority Leader who was also convicted and then
Joe Bruno.
That's right, and was able to escape on appeal. As a former Assembly Speaker who was convicted and then was able to be exonerated. That's right. You have all of your historical sort of, you know, trivia questions answered. So, I mean, there's certainly some precedent on that. The case against Silver is a complicated case. And so he may feel like he could be exonerated. I mean, you know, that's his right, right? But right now he's convicted. He's a convicted felon. He's out of the legislature. His political career is over. And the dancing on his political grave has already begun.
But I've thought about that. You know, they made a great deal. As soon as he was convicted, they scraped his name off the door,
That's right.
did all of that. They kicked him out unceremoniously. They probably took his credit card away. Anyway, but here's the deal. What happens if he's exonerated? Did he have to go back and put his name back on the door?
He has to run, right? He's out of office.
Right.
So he's done now. He's politically done. It's similar to what happened with Bruno, right? So, I mean, Bruno could run for office and if he wanted to. Now, Silver is in his early 70s. He may not. He's a young man.
So
right, he may want to, but we'll see, right? I mean, if he gets exonerated before November of 2016, he could certainly run again if he chose to do that.
Okay.
But he won't go back as Speaker.
No.
And that won't be any fun. So I would be surprised if he ran.
And what's
if he was exonerated.
And what are we thinking about Boss Hastie from the Bronx, who is now the new Speaker? Personally, I didn't think it was an inspired choice by those people who are attesting to their potential for reform to take the guy who was the head of the Bronx organization and make him the Speaker. But how's he been doing?
Well, you know, it's just there's two aspects to look at. One is sort of the mechanics of whether or not the assembly is doing whatever the heck the assembly is supposed to do. And then there's the second issue is, as a leader, is he responding to the winds for change, you know, the winds of change? On the first part, there is no evidence that the mechanics were breaking down. I mean, the bureaucracy of the assembly churned along. He was able to hammer out, do his part in hammering out a budget deal. He's been around for 15 years, so he's not like a new kid on the block when it comes to how the assembly operates. That being said, there'll be a change in the staff leadership. We'll see what next year brings. On the reform side, there's no evidence that he's going to be a reformer. There is none at all, other than sort of rhetorical.
And well, but the rhetorical is important. Can't
well,
we
the rhetorical, to some extent, though, has been quite muted. I mean, he said he was going to create a task force to look at changes in legislative rules. He created them. They've done nothing. And it's, you know, 8 months later. So whether or not he's committed, really, you know, in Albany, you know, you always hear the old phrase, actions speak louder than words. Mm. In Albany, inaction speaks louder than words. And right now we have nothing but inaction and excuses and muted responses from all the political leaders. The Assembly Speaker, the Senate Majority Leader, and the governor are all saying nothing needs to get done. In fact, last week, I think it was Lieutenant Governor Hochul was arguing it's the legislature that needs to take the lead on reform. And so that seemed to me, again, a way for the executive branch to sort of keep a distance from the scandals that have engulfed the legislature.
Now you've gone and raised my interest. You've piqued my interest in something, Blair Horner.
Finally. How many times have we been talking?
Oh, no,
this
no,
is
no,
the
no.
first. This
you
is the first.
You all knew. You're terrific. But you mentioned Lieutenant Governor Hochul. I would love to stand out in front of the Capitol and ask the first 100 people who passed what the name of the lieutenant governor is.
But you could do that for almost every lieutenant governor.
Absolutely could. Absolutely could. And often they think that they're a heartbeat away from being the governor or the vice president, a heartbeat away from being the president. And sometimes that's happened. After all, that's how we got Governor Patterson after Elliot Spitzer resigned. So with this sort of smoke, which we have already decided may just be that smoke and nothing else, there's always a chance that this woman, who was a failed congresswoman, she got beat.
Well, she won and then got beat. So
she won once and then she got beat. And so whether she could become the governor eventually, what do you know about her? Is she equipped?
I dealt with her a little bit when she was in the Congress, and I didn't deal with her much when she was the Erie County Clerk. So she's, you know, been a successful...
Stamping those marriage licenses.
Right. She's been, in fact, didn't want to remember when Spitzer had the driver's licenses option for immigrants? She was one of the county clerks that didn't want to do that, as I recall.
Yeah.
But she struck me in the few times I dealt with her as very smart. She's shrewd, I think, in terms of figuring out the audience that she's talking to. She's a former lobbyist for M&T Bank. So she
big
had,
bank.
It's a big bank. Her husband is a U.S. attorney from Western New York. And, you know, she has a lot of sort of pretty high-level experiences. And whether or not somebody can handle being governor, you never really know until they get the job. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have a vast experience in terms of the executive branch. I mean, Governor Cuomo, one of his hallmarks, I think, was, you know, as HUD, since he was former HUD secretary, he had been the head of a vast, gigantic, sprawling bureaucracy, which I think gave him some experiences to help him deal with the vast sprawling.
And he helped run his father's administration.
And he was very involved in his father's administration. Now, again, you know, Governor Pataki, who, you know, I mean, whatever you think about his policies, he ran for three terms as governor, and he had no real executive experiences except the mayor of Peekskill. So it's really hard to tell until people get into office whether or not they can do it. But she's always struck me as a smart, charismatic, and sort of capable politician.
Blair Horner, while we're talking, you know, about all of this, do you notice a change in the way in which Andrew Cuomo is conducting his governorship? I mean, I see a kinder, gentler Andrew as opposed to the fiery, get even with, I'll take this person on governor.
I would hesitate to draw too much of a conclusion right now. I think we're in the pre-legislative session part of what's going on. I mean, last year, as far as I could tell, he was as fierce an advocate for what he believed as he was the prior year.
Yeah, but he's not picking fights with as many people as he was before. For example, the teachers seemed to be exempted.
He was willing to revisit.
That was a dumb move when he took on.
Well, I mean, actually, you hope elected officials, when they make a bad policy move, are willing to reconsider it and fix it. I mean, it's hard to... again, this is not one of the issues I have worked on or have any expertise in, but from what I understand, it's hard to base an evaluation for teachers on a testing system that apparently is flawed, right? I mean, that Sure. seems like a bad way to go about it. I mean, the idea of evaluating teachers to, you know, keep the good ones in the classroom and move the bad ones out, it certainly makes sense. But if you don't have the appropriate, valid vehicle to do it, then you can't move ahead. And so
sure.
It appears to me that the governor's reconsidering that position and circling
back. Only because he got his ears boxed, don't you think?
The teachers union is big, big political player.
I can't talk to a teacher who doesn't scowl when the governor's name is mentioned. You've been around politicians for a long time. So now that the governor is basically changing his tune and being kinder and nicer to the teachers, do those million or so people and their families, do they forgive and forget and say, okay, now he's our guy?
Well,
you know about this stuff.
Yeah, you know, it hinges on lots of things that we don't even know about, right? I mean, the governor, if he runs for a third term, does not have to sort of make a decision for another year plus.
I predict he's going to run.
Well, you know.
No place to go.
That may well be the case. It may well be, but whatever, he certainly has to act like he is now, right? No matter what he
does. Sure, otherwise
right?
He's a lame duck.
That's right. And so there's a whole year for things to sort of play out where the governor could do things that could repair fences with the teachers if he chose to do so, or which may have appeal to teachers generally, although teachers tend to be, while very well-educated and knowledgeable, they are a diverse group. They're not a homogenous union. There's Republicans as well as Democrats.
And not particularly, quote, political. In other words, I'm talking about individual teachers, not their union.
That's right.
But in this case, boy, they got mad.
Well, and, you know, and teachers are feeling under siege across the country. And the fact that the governor, I'm sure they viewed it as the governor was piling on them in New York.
Yeah.
And that tune could change. He could come up with policies that teachers, rank and file teachers, may think are good ideas. And he's got a whole year plus to do it. So, in politics, and a year is a really long time. And how people react to individuals can change. That being said, it's very hard to change when the public perception of you, once it becomes really fixed.
Now,
and I think the governor's done a pretty good job of tacking back and forth in terms of his public image that I don't think that people have a fixed view of him as a bad guy.
Now, Blair Horner, you worked for this governor when he was attorney general, doing what I could only say is God's work, trying to make sure that the parts of government were open to public inspection.
That's right.
And then when you thought you had accomplished that, you left and went back to this very important work you're doing now at New York Public Interest Research Group, and really are, I would say, without question, the most respected lobbyist in New York State.
I don't know. Are you damning me with faint praise?
No, especially the
most respected lobbyist.
Now, the governor asked you to do that because, you know, it was important to him when he was attorney general to make sure that everybody could see everything. How are they doing now? I mean, here we are. I've heard some bitching from the, you know, from the press about access to the governor. This is a guy who called you in and borrowed from your respectability to have you do this. I'm not in any way impugning you. But now the question is, has he sort of turned back on that mission?
I don't know if he's turned back on the mission. Again, people have talked to me about this because of what you just described, right? I think the governor, again, I don't want to speak for him, but my view is that the governor has sort of like, he looks at the government information in two different ways. There's the access to government data using technology. And I think the governor's been pretty interested in doing things to sort of make government data more accessible to the public.
Like what?
You can get databases, for example, that were very hard to get in the past. So if you want to
look up Alan Chartok if he's a SUNY professor and see how much he's making.
Well, that you can get that from an outside group, actually, not from the government. But although that information the government makes available.
Right.
And so if you wanted to get the, for example, you want to go on a website and get information on the vaccine rates of certain kinds of hospitals, for example, or procedures that are done, you can get that information. It was always public, but now you just go to the health department's portal and you can access all sorts of information very easily. So there's that. Then there's the sort of how does government make its decisions side of it? And he does not, as far as I can tell, want the public to see that.
For example,
the governor's, the way that the governor handled the Moreland Commission, for example, mm-hmm. was good because it's appropriate to what we've been talking about. You know, there was a real effort to sort of lock down what it was that they were discussing. And
by the governor's office, the second floor was trying, despite the fact that the Moreland Commission
was supposed to be independent, right, that they were really directing it and trying to get
it. They were trying to direct it.
And they were trying to, they were keeping them from talking about what they thought. Now, so there's like different aspects of this. And so I think like when I went to work for the Attorney General, then Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, the project was more on the technology side. We weren't breaking new ground in terms of new access to information. We were making it easier for people to get access to existing information. And so I think that's where the line gets drawn in his mind, is that when it comes to the sausage-making side of government, he wants to keep it as much as he can under wraps. When it comes to, in a sense, almost like a public service, that the government collects data and it's stored in databases, and the public should have easy access to that, and technology can make that happen. I think he's very interested in that. So that's how I see the two of them. And certainly from NYPERG's point of view, we think the government is too closed, and we think there needs to be more things to make government more open and accountable to the public, because the government is not its own entity. It is to serve the public. And how do you serve it if nobody knows what you're doing? But I think in the terms of with your question, I think it's sort of split in the way that I described.
Mm-hmm. If Hillary Clinton loses to Donald Trump, that would open up an opportunity for Andrew Cuomo to run for president eventually. He's still a very young man. Do you hear much talk on the hustings about Andrew for president?
No. Short answer, no. There were more discussions earlier on before Mrs. Clinton chose to run for president. There were a lot more noises that the governor, particularly early on in his first term, was presidential timber. He comes from a big state. He's got name recognition. There's never been an Italian-American elected president. He had his sort of sister soldier moment where he was taking on the public employee unions in New York and yet advancing, you know, marriage equality and gun control. But with Mrs. Clinton on the playing field, that sort of, I think, sucked all the wind out of the, all the air, oxygen out of the room when it came to anybody else running for president. And we've seen that so far. But, I think that if Mrs. Clinton gets the nomination, loses running for president, that's when the chattering classes will start up again, but not before that.
Okay, we only have a couple of minutes, but I wanted to ask you about the Constitutional Convention. It's hotting up. You know, every so often, New Yorkers have to vote on whether or not we're going to have another Constitutional Convention. In the past, I believe, in contrast to my very dear good friend Jerry Benjamin, who tends to lead this charge in New York State, that con-cons have been a colossal waste of money and time, and the political class tends to control them. So therefore—
If they even happen. I mean, the last one that was happened, 67, the legislature convened that one.
Yeah.
The votes, I believe, in the ones in 57, 77, and 97 all went down, right? Yeah. So the Constitutional Conventions don't really happen much.
Yeah. Well, let's put it this way. There's still a huge cry for this Constitutional Convention to happen, and people are saying, let's have education reform. But we have a lot in place that we don't do. The courts have come down and say, you got to provide a decent education for everybody. Right. We don't do that. And so I don't know that wasting this money and putting on yet another circus is a great idea.
Well, I mean, it depends on whether or not you like the circus, right? And so,
I like the circus, although the exploitation of animals, is absolutely terrible.
Right. I mean, the discussion, you know, you're absolutely right. The debate is heating up on whether or not to convene a Constitutional Convention. All of your listeners will get an opportunity to vote on whether or not they think there should be one in November of 2017.
And the reason all our listeners, because a lot of them, like me, live in Massachusetts, Vermont, Connecticut.
That's right.
Rhode Island.
Well, then they get a chance to sort of call in and tell people what to do. But I think if the argument is that the Constitutional Convention is a vehicle to fix Albany, it will fail.
Sure.
As a vote. Because I don't think the public believes Albany's easily fixed.
Especially since the guys who will be in the Constitutional Convention are the cousin Louis from the guy who needs to be fixed.
And so I think it has to be, if advocates want to see a Constitutional Convention, it has to be based on things that can be done that would make people's lives better that are not happening now.
Like?
Well, so for example, right now you have a constitutional protection for a 40-hour work week under the state constitution, right to trial, a sound basic education, right to organize, protection of pensions. All those things are enshrined, the Adirondack Park, the Catskill Park, all those things are part of the Constitution now. You could say, for example, that you have a constitutional right to health care. And that would mean that everyone in the state guaranteed access to health care.
But Blair.
And so that might be, but that is an example of a compelling argument that people would think to themselves, this is a good thing. I like this. If this is about fixing Albany, I think it's hard to imagine how it passes.
And not only that, but there are a lot of people who say, okay, I don't want them to take all those good things. I don't want them to muck around with the good things.
All of the things that I just described, there are constituent groups that want to see those things protected and are terrified that if you had a constitutional convention, that you could lose them. The counter argument is, if they're so popular, why would they ever get taken out, right? And so that's the debate. That's the 2017 debate. Are you willing to risk, roll the dice on a constitution that many people like a lot for things that could make the system of Albany better and maybe in other ways? Or are you not willing to roll the dice and keep a constitution that was essentially written in the first half of the 20th century in place?
But you said earlier in the show, and you were absolutely right, if the legislature wants to come along and fix their transgressions right now legislation, they can do it, and it won't take a multi-million-dollar constitutional convention and a colossal waste of money to do that.
Well, it certainly wouldn't take a colossal waste of money. I couldn't argue with it. You're doing a very good job of creating the straw man on this. We should get Jerry on this show.
Well, he's been on the show and will continue to be on the show. Okay, so Blair Horner, we love having you with us. Blair Horner, of course, is our hero, the executive director of NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group. Congratulations again, Blair, on your accession to the head job in that organization. And thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.